Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1989, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a novelist. It was as a mother who enjoyed reading to her children that she discovered her passion for writing, and she published her first children's book in her late 30s. 6 years later, she wrote her first novel. She's now recognised as one of Britain's leading writers. She's published 8 novels, 2 of them have been shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and one, Moon Tiger, won it in 1987. But she is no literary elitist. She also writes short stories for popular magazines like Woman's Own, Good Housekeeping and Cosmopolitan. She is Penelope Lively. The demand, then, for women's magazine stories is as great as ever, is it, Penelope?
It is, but the interesting thing is that it's a different kind of demand. Nowadays, magazines like this, Cosmopolitan or Good Housekeeping, are publishing what are called literary stories, which I don't think they would have done 15 years or so ago. Then the idea was that women only wanted to read romantic fiction, and patently it isn't true.
But, of course, short story writing is an art in itself, isn't it? There are many novelists who simply can't do it.
That's absolutely true. It's different. It's a way of using an idea. It's a way of doing something that presents, I think, a sort of flash of life rather than the great exploratory business, which is a novel. I love doing it, but again, it's a frustrating process because you can't just go out and find a short story. They either arrive or they don't. The working at them process is completely different from working as a novel.
Have you ever written a short story about loneliness or life on a desert island?
I can't say I have, not exactly, no. It's not a bad subject, but of course it has been done.
So are you going to enjoy yourself, do you think, on the island, or would you hate that whole idea?
I'd enjoy it for about 48 hours, I think. I rather like solitude, and 48 hours would be wonderful. After that, I'd get frantic, and I'd panic, and I'd do all the wrong things.
So escape would be high on the agenda?
It certainly would.
But you're a nature lover and a gardener, aren't you? I would have thought, to an extent, you would have been in your element.
I might, yes, but as I said, it would pall because of all the other things that are necessary. Yes, I'd start, I imagine, trying to grow the garden and plant the things for next season, but then I'd panic because I hadn't got any books to read.
Let's hear some of your music. What's the first piece you'd like to take?
I'd like an aria from Mozart's opera Zaida, which is an opera that's not nearly as well known as it should be. And this is partly in honour of my daughter, who's an oboist. And some while ago, she played the oboe part in this. And there's this wonderful aria, which is a duet between oboe and voice.
Sanft mein holdes Leben from Mozart's opera Zaida, sung by Edith Matisse with the Berlin State Orchestra conducted by Bernhard Klee. Do you believe, Penelope, that writers are born rather than made? I ask that because, as I said in the introduction, you never wrote a thing until you were well into your 30s, a comparative latecomer.
I don't think that you can teach yourself to write or learn to write, but at the same time, I think that writers are in a constant state of learning and improvement, as it were. I think you start to write probably because there's something in you, there's some innate passion to do it. What you then spend the rest of the time doing is honing it down, is learning how to do it.
But why did your innate passion take so long to emerge?
Goodness knows. I think probably partly diffidence, I imagine. I when I look back, I can see, in a sense, the germs of it. I've always been an absolutely avid reader since childhood, and having had a rather odd childhood without much formal education. But that went on and on. And I think that in a curious way, the reading was a kind of preparation. There was certainly a way of discovering style and discovering taste, which eventually, yes, started to burst out, but as you rightly say, extremely late.
But were you an avid letter writer, or were you aware that you had a way with words, as they say?
Not particularly, no. When I was a student at Oxford, I didn't find writing essays difficult. The writing part, I remember, came easily, but I wasn't a very assiduous student. And I do remember, in fact, one tutor saying to me in despair, "This is an extraordinarily elegantly written essay, but it says nothing at all."
So by the time you started to write, you were married to a university lecturer. You had two children, and you'd been very busy rearing them. Were you one of those housewives who was determined you were going to do something?
In a sense, I was, yes. I can see that what I was doing, in a way, was preparing myself for something. I was a passionate reader, as I've said, and I'm one of the many people who owe an enormous debt to the public library system. When the children were small, at least twice a week, I used to be trundling the pram along to our local branch library. We were living then, first of all, in Swansea and then in Sussex, and there were small branch libraries, that kind of library that's about the size of a large room. And I just read my way around these libraries, so that the memories of those years are very much of keeping the baby quiet with one hand and turning the pages of a book with the other.
So is that the image that your children would have of you, that you were constantly book in hand stirring the soup?
I wonder, I don't know. They may well remember it as passing clouds of irritation because they interrupted me reading. And I read with them and to them a great deal because I'd by then become very interested in children's literature and also felt passionately this is something I wanted to share with children. So there was a good deal of reading with them and to them also, as well as reading to myself.
Shall we pause there for your second record?
My second record is a piece of vicarious anguish. It's a part of Schutz's Christmas story. And when my son was a small boy, he had a treble voice, and he was at Magdalen College School, and at one point was a member of the choir, and he sang the angel part in this at I think it was the school Christmas concert, and I can't hear it ever without that feeling of awful sort of sinking in the stomach of, you know, would he get through it or not, because his voice was about to break.
Part of Heinrich Schütz's Christmas story, sung by Adele Stolte with the Schwabische Orchestra, conducted by Hans Grischkat. How did you come then, Penelope, to write your first book? Was it a case of reading them to children and thinking, I can do better than that?
Well, I think it was a case of thinking I could have a go at it, at least. And the first one I wrote was an absolutely appalling short historical novel, which mercifully never found a publisher. The next one was a book called Astercoat, which is still in print after all this time. I must say, I don't much like to look at it now. I don't think many writers like to go back to their first book. But that did find a publisher. And then the children's books came one after another, really, all in a great rush, I now realise, perhaps making up for lost time.
The Ghost of Thomas Kemp was perhaps one of the most successful of your children's books. That was 1974, so 4 years after the first one was published. You won this award for that, didn't you? The Carnegie Medal, very prestigious. Can you remember your reaction? Were you shocked or surprised?
Oh, I was awfully thrilled. I was thrilled. It was the first prize I'd won since being at school, as it were. So it seemed extraordinary. I don't otherwise remember very much about it.
But even when you wrote that, your own children were in their early teens, I think. What did they think, suddenly, to have this literary figure in the household?
Well, I doubt if they thought about it like that. I think, subsequently, I've learned that they were quite glad that it sort of kept me off their backs, as it were. It meant that I was beginning to be busier and busier, and so instead of hanging round their necks telling them what to do and what not to do, I was only too glad to leave them to get on with it and shuffle off to my study and get on with something. They've both said, subsequently, that having a working mother is a very good thing, and I've come to feel that too, I must say.
Shall we have some more music?
My next piece of music is some country and western. I'm rather partial to country and western, and I have a particular taste for George Jones. So this is George Jones' Howlin' at the Moon.
I know there's never been a man in the awful shape I'm in. I can't even spell my name, my head's in such a spin. Today I tried to eat a steak with a big old tablespoon. You got me chasing rabbits, walking on my hands, and howling at the moon. Well, sugar, I took one look at you, and it almost drove me mad.
George Jones, Howling at the Moon. Tell me, Penelope, about winning the Booker Prize. You'd been shortlisted twice before, I think, hadn't you?
Yes, I had, and the first time was a long time ago, about 10 years ago, when there was far less commotion about it. It was all rather low-key and tranquil then, and indeed you were told beforehand that you hadn't won. I was told with a certain satisfaction by my publisher that I hadn't won, because, in fact, one of his other authors had won.
Who was that?
That was Paul Scott.
That was the Raj Quartet.
That's right, yes, it was for one book of that.
And yours was The Road to Lichfield, which was your first novel.
It was. So that, yes, it was very exciting to have it recognised in this way.
It was incredible, really, for a first novel, wasn't it?
Well, it was encouraging. It was.
And that really, though, is a love story, isn't it, about this married woman who journeys to Lichfield to be with her dying father and happens to meet a sympathetic schoolmaster.
It's about love, and it's also about memory. I mean, I was working out the strain that I still have and had then about the function of memory, the ways in which we use and abuse memory. It's something that's very much, I suppose, run through the children's books, and then I was looking for another way of talking about it. Now I've moved in, I think, into all sorts of other and different ways of talking about it.
Because, of course, Moon Tiger, which did win the Booker Prize a couple of years ago, is again very much concerned with time. As you say, it's about a woman lying, dying in hospital, revisiting her life through memories and voices. Did you feel, when you wrote that there was something special about it? Did you think, this could be it?
It was a book that, in a way, I'd been waiting to write for a long time, because part of it, the central part, is set in Egypt, where I'd been born and grown up, or at least spent most of my childhood until I was 13, during the war. And I'd always wanted to write about this, but had never seen any way of writing about it that wouldn't be some boring, totally autobiographical novel about somebody growing up in Egypt. And it wasn't until I went back there with my husband and some friends for the first time since I was a child that I suddenly saw a way of doing it, that I saw a way of using the sort of things that I wanted to write about anyway and building them around that place, and also specifically using my own memories, using my own experience of that time and that place to inform the structure of the book. It all came within a few months of coming back from Egypt after that package holiday.
A friend of mine, a male friend, says that he finds your leading females extremely sexy. How do you react to that?
Oh, that's interesting. Certainly, Claudia in Moon Tiger provokes violent extremes of feeling in people. And men do react very strongly. Either they can't abide her or they think she's marvellous. Yes, they have that response and they find her very sexy, which I think probably says more about them than about her.
What does it say about you?
Well, that, again, would be hard for me to say. I enjoyed writing Claudia because she's a strong and powerful woman. I'm always being asked if she's in any sense autobiographical. She certainly isn't. She's not like me. On the other hand, I respect her and admire her. I rather like women like that. I'm less forceful, I think, than she is, and less combative. But maybe she's the kind of person I would have liked to be.
Shall we have your fourth record?
This is a piece of, in a sense, nostalgia. This was a piece of courtship music for me. It's one of Richard Strauss's four last songs. And when my husband was courting me, he quite properly, in the conventional way, used to ask me up to hear his records. And at that point, he was deeply into Mahler and Strauss.
Christel Galtz singing Beim Schlafengehen, one of Richard Strauss's four last songs with the Pro Musica Orchestra of Vienna, conducted by Heinrich Hollreiser. Penelope, we seem to have cast chronology aside ourselves here because I haven't yet asked you about your childhood. You said it was rather strange and you had no formal education.
I didn't go to school in Egypt. Allegedly, there was no school for me to go to, so I was educated at home entirely by a sort of governess who did it through a kind of do-it-yourself education kit, which was sent out from England, which sent out the books and the timetables, which frequently didn't arrive. They went to the bottom of the Mediterranean, along with rather more vital wartime supplies. And these were then administered in a very kind of haphazard way, with sort of lessons in the mornings if we felt like it. But the curious thing is that haphazard as it was, in fact, for me, it was just the right thing, because it was an education based entirely on narrative. The idea was telling a story, so that it was the Bible, Greek and Norse mythology. And the form was that you read to the child and then the child told the story back before they could write. And then when they could write, they wrote back. So that the emphasis was very much on narrative and on language. And I think it probably did a great deal for me, in fact. It taught me to listen, to read, to control language. It was profoundly short on science. There was no science at all except something called nature study, which we kind of went out and did by fishing things out of Nile-fed canals and looking at them. And there was very little mathematics. I remember the timetable said for Wednesdays, it said arithmetic or handicraft, so we opted for handicraft. So when I did eventually get to a proper school, to a boarding school, I was technically, as it were, behind, but in a curious way also advanced in that I was very good at reading and writing.
But it was also, obviously, from what you say, really rather a solitary business, your childhood.
It was extremely solitary, because I was an only child anyway, and I communed with animals and with nature. I had guinea pigs and a dog and this kind of thing, and these were companions. And told myself stories, I realise now, without writing them down, but I do remember being in a state of kind of continuous narrative, and indeed have done so ever since. But I've always thought that everybody did that. I now realise that perhaps they don't.
So where were you when war broke out?
In England, in fact, I was then six, and I was staying with my grandparents in Somerset, and my parents had already gone back to Egypt, and so I was sent with this nurse governess and a whole group of other women and children with spouses in the Middle East, sent back on a kind of train caravan of these people across France in late September of 1939 to catch a boat at Marseille and thence be shipped to Egypt. The only thing I can remember about all this is my constant anguish and panic about the gas mask. We each had to have a gas mask with us, and we'd been sternly told that if you lost your gas mask, the Germans would come and gas you. Well, I had no idea what either Germans or gas were, but I remember clinging to this thing frantically, and yes, eventually losing it in a train.
But you came home to England after the war, didn't you? Feeling, you said, rather like a refugee, a foreigner.
I felt totally and utterly displaced, and I was about 12, going on 13, and felt totally like a refugee, and was sent immediately, or almost immediately, to boarding school, which was a fairly brutal experience for a child who hadn't been to any kind of school. In fact, it was completely horrific. It was a boarding school of unremitting Philistinism. It seems to me extraordinary. I wonder if there are still such places. It was in Seaford on the south coast. One of the punishments at this school was to go and spend an hour in the library reading. I can also remember being sent for by the headmistress, and one went, of course, quaking, knowing that you must have transgressed in some fearful way, and finding her sitting at an enormous desk with my copy of the Oxford Book of English Verse in front of her, which, she explained, had been confiscated from my locker by the matron because, she said, there is no need for you to read this kind of thing in your spare time. You are here to be taught all that.
No wonder you were a latecomer to writing. I mean, you obviously felt somehow it was some kind of crime.
Oh, yes. I went underground, in a sense. I mean, the whole ethic being put into you at this school was that affection for literature and enjoyment of literature, or indeed of learning, really, was a perversion, and that a nice girl and a healthy, decent girl got out and played lacrosse. This was what the heroines at this school did. So that someone like me was a total and complete misfit, and I thought, well, yes, obviously I am perverted, I am some kind of freak, so that the only thing is just to go away and do it in private.
Let's have your fifth piece of music, shall we?
My fifth piece of music is, again, more oboe music. Josephine, my daughter, played this, the Haydn Oboe Concerto, when she was 16 in a school concert in St Mary's Church in Oxford. And again, I can still remember the vicarious anxiety of sitting there listening.
Part of Haydn's Oboe Concerto in C, played by Heinz Holliger with the Concertgebouw Orchestra of Amsterdam, conducted by David Zinman. Well, now, we were saying, Penelope, you've written eight novels, grown-up books, as it were, and countless children's books. Where do all the ideas come from? You say that they're in your head and you pluck them out, but where do they come from?
I don't go out and look for a novel, in a sense. It seems to arise from the things that I've been thinking about and the way that I'm looking at the world. But often the structure or the subject or the story even is prompted by something seen. The book that I'm working on at the moment, which is a London novel, was in one sense sparked off by a painting. In fact, it's a painting by my aunt, Rachel Reckitt, that she painted from a drawing that she'd made during the early years of the Blitz in 40 and 41. And it's a very disturbing and powerful oil painting of a blitzed building in Queen Victoria Street. And I've looked at this a lot, and it acted, in a sense, as a prompt.
You don't believe, then, that you, as many writers say, have to have experienced that which you're going to write about?
Certainly not. In one way you do, of course, yes, but I think that the limitation for every writer is, of course, personal experience. We only live one life under one set of circumstances, and what you're forever trying to do is escape this prison of experience and be able to change your own reality, as it were, into the rather different reality of fiction.
So how do you actually set about doing the writing? Do you write a certain number of words every day in a set place?
First of all, there's just a great deal of what I would call moving around and thinking. And then there's a note-taking process when for months I just put things down in a notebook, scraps of dialogue that will eventually go into the book, instructions to myself of one kind or another. And only when there's quite a lot of that am I ready to start writing.
And then how many hours a day do you write, and where do you do it?
When I'm actually doing it, I would write a sort of office hour day from about 9 till 5, and on the whole probably in our Oxfordshire home. At the moment, because of the way life is, I don't get enough weeks for doing that. There tends to be sort of a couple of weeks when I can do that, and then there's a week when I have other things that I must do. So there aren't long stretches of time when I'm just sitting doing nothing but write anymore.
And is it all enjoyable?
What is enjoyable is when it's going well. Yes, there's nothing like it. There's nothing so heady as knowing that you've done a good day's work and then looking at it the next morning and it still looks good. But there are points when it's dispiriting, yes, when you get stuck. I mean, this thing that's called writer's block, which I think is just what it means, is simply that you've got stuck. You don't see where the book goes next. You cannot see how it ever will. But the one thing you do learn after a number of books is that it does somehow unhitch itself, or so far it has done.
Another record, please.
This is a Schubert Lieder, Shepherd on the Rock, sung by Margaret Price. I have a passion for the human voice. I think a lot of people most admire the thing that they know they couldn't possibly do, and I have no voice at all. I can't sing in tune, so I'm very, very fond of hearing other people able to do so.
Schubert's The Shepherd on the Rocks, sung by Margaret Price, accompanied by Wolfgang Swarlich and Hans Schoneberger. You obviously now, Penelope, lead a really very hectic life, promoting your books here and abroad, and indeed presenting Treasure Islands on Radio 4 and thinking about your new novel, as we've been saying. I presume you're busier than you've ever been.
I am busy, yes. Last year I travelled an enormous amount. This year I'm not doing so much deliberately because I'm trying to write this book, but I do work for literary organisations like the Society of Authors and at the moment for the Arts Council. I hasten to say, because I enjoy it, and partly because it gets one away from the desk. Writing is a solitary occupation. I'm a fairly gregarious person, and I don't think I could any longer sit behind a desk for 5 days a week. It would drive me distracted.
But is there perhaps an irony in the fact that as a writer you must have time to stand and stare, and your success, the recognition of Penelope Lively, has robbed her of that?
Standing and staring is important, and that is in fact what I'm not getting, because I think I've rather ceased to write short stories because they do very much arise from periods of fallowness, from periods of tranquility. That's when the ideas suddenly come. And I'm not getting that at the moment. So I think it would be no bad thing, in fact, to have a fallow year or so.
How has your husband, who is a professor of politics, how has he reacted to all of this? I ask that in the sense that for the first 16 years of your life, as we've heard, you were the mother of his children and you were there at home, although you had the odd academic job. Now, the second 16 years of marriage, you have become this prominent public figure.
We've learned to sort of adjust to each other's lives because he's also extremely busy. And so we are operating in completely different areas, and we're together as much as we possibly can be within that context. But he's had, yes, this problem that he married one person who then turned into another. And he's gone along with it magnificently.
But I suspect for you, you've led your life the right way around, that your family came first and always would have done. And now you're enjoying the success.
They probably would, I think. Yes, I enormously enjoyed the children. I have to say I felt as exasperated and frustrated and shut in as anyone does when there were small children. But I'm very glad that I had that period of doing nothing but look after them when they were really small, yes.
Shall we have your seventh record?
My seventh record, I think I would need something soothing on this island. So this is a Chopin nocturne.
Chopin Nocturne, Opus 9, Number 1 in B-flat minor, played by Artur Rubinstein. One wouldn't call you a feminist writer, Penelope. Do you care to be pigeonholed? Are you happy to be called a woman writer?
Not particularly, no. I think this is a fairly meaningless expression. After all, one doesn't talk about men writers. I'm simply a novelist, and that's it.
Except that if one picked up one of your books and didn't know who had written it, and I feel sure that after a few pages one would know it was a woman writing.
I agree with you, I think that's true, and I would say the same of other kinds of writers, both men and women. I don't know what it is, what particular gender quality it is that makes itself apparent in fiction, but it certainly does. I mean, at ludicrous extremes, of course, the female novel, as it were, is romantic fiction, and the male novel is macho stuff of one kind or another. But one would feel that in the middle, in literary fiction, there shouldn't be this definable gender distinction, but patently there is. I wish I knew what it was.
Who do you read? Who do you admire?
I suppose I go back a lot to old favourites. I think I'm always going back to the Russians, to Turgenev particularly, and Dickens. I mean, the books that I reread every few years, there would always be a Dickens on the boil. I'm very partial to a number of American writers, and actually women writers particularly, say, like Edith Wharton or Willa Cather. But it's an eclectic list, and one that there are constantly additions to and constantly changing. For instance, Henry James at the moment. I'm suddenly finding a violent antipathy to Henry James. I always thought I liked him.
But do you read any of the blockbuster gang? Do you read Jackie Collins or Harold Robbins or Jeffrey Archer?
I never have done, no. I try. I had a Jeffrey Archer once, and with the best will in the world, yes, I couldn't get very far.
And you haven't tried a Jackie Collins?
I haven't, no.
I'd be fascinated to know what you thought. So they're not going to be your chosen author on the island. Who is? What is the book you've chosen to take with you?
Oh, that really was an immense problem, but after considerable thought, I think I would take Moby Dick, because obviously one would need a large book in every sense, and Moby Dick is an immensely long book. It's also one of the largest novels in scope that there is. It's something that would give me a vast amount of food for thought, and I would never get to the bottom of it, so that it would bear the number of rereadings that it would have to have.
Let's hear your last record, shall we?
My last record would be Uplift, that one would definitely need on this island. So, Purcell's Come Ye Sons of Art.
This triumphant day, tune all your voices and instruments play, to celebrate this triumphant day, to celebrate this triumphant day.
Purcell's Come Ye Sons of Art with the Monteverdi Choir and Orchestra conducted by John Elliot Gardiner. So now, which of those records, Penelope, would give you best comfort on the island?
I'd take the Zaida, I think, because that would both give me the marvellous beauty of it and also it's uplifting, it's enhancing music, it would cheer me up.
And your luxury?
I've always assumed that this island is in the South Pacific, so presumably it's bird-infested, and I've always been an enthusiastic amateur bird watcher, so my luxury would simply be a pair of binoculars.
Penelope Lively, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.